All right, so on page, what did I say, 55? This is wrapping up Daniel chapter 6, of course, the lion's den, Daniel in the lion's den. And so we've got our gospel glimpses, the whole Bible connections, theological soundings, and then any other personal implications. So I thought I'd pick out a few from this that I thought were pretty good, but I thought I'd start by asking if anybody had anything that they particularly, specifically saw that they had written down that they liked. There's a lot of good stuff in that passage. Yeah. I like that too. His character didn't decline in the least, did it? I mean, if anything, his old age character put his young age to shame, right? I've never been 80. I don't know. I've never been thrown in a lion's den. I've never been 80 and thrown in a lion's den. But I would probably choose just about anything over that. So, you know, I mean, You can read Lion's Den and be like, oh yeah, the story that we read to our kids, you know, once a month or whatever. You go, wow, no, lions and being thrown, and this is...
But how his faithfulness, like, just persevered every time.
Every time, yeah. Yeah, no, that's good. That was one of the things, I think I mentioned it a couple of weeks ago when we were in there, that I found particularly striking about what it is that Darius says about Daniel. Which verse was it? Oh, just that he put Daniel over the whole kingdom. One of the three high officials, one of the presidents. I think that's the language Mike used. And that Daniel, verse 3 of chapter 6, became distinguished above all the other high officials and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. And how I think that is speaking of the same character that the New Testament church is to look for in their leaders. 1 Timothy chapter 3, the saying is trustworthy: if anyone aspires to the office of overseer, that is pastor, he desires a noble task. Therefore, an overseer must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, sober-minded, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not a drunkard, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. He must manage his own household well with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. If anyone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? He must not be a recent convert. He may become puffed up with conceit and fall into the condemnation of the devil. Right here, verse 7. Moreover, he must be well thought of by outsiders, that he may not fall into disgrace, into a snare of the devil. And I think verse 7 right there, that's Daniel, right? I mean, he's so well thought of by outsiders that this invading country that takes over the nation would say, hey, that's a trustworthy guy. I'm going to put him with the other two presidents over the land, and then he's actually the best one, so I plan on giving him the most because he's the most distinguished. Wow. I think that's what that character's pointing to, talking about right there. Yeah. You guys have anything else that you saw, that you liked? Yeah. Yeah. You guys hear that up front? What he said? Yeah. It's pretty similar, isn't it? To the point that they couldn't find anything to stick to him, and the only time that he got caught, in essence, was when he opened his mouth, right? And he said to Jesus, "Are you the Son of God?" "Yes, I am the Son of God." "Okay, well, blasphemy," right? Daniel, we got to get him to open his mouth. We make it so he can't pray to his God. He prays to his God, and then he's, yeah. Striking. I don't know if you read through these in the book. I know how you guys are with your homework. Like, well, what chapter are we? he had some good ones in here. This, I think there's some gospel application. Rescued from lions. I mean, lion is often used of, in the New Testament, of the devil prowling around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. Who is it that overcomes the world except the one who believes that Jesus is the Son of God? And that's a good one. Daniel entrusted himself to the one who judges justly. That's a big one. Understanding that, you know, he might die. I mean, because the reality is, when you get thrown in a den of lions, I don't know any other outcome other than getting eaten alive. You know, we doubt that Daniel expected to come out alive, right? That's what Abraham didn't expect to come down the mountain with Isaac, right? He was surprised when the angel stopped him. Daniel, I think, was surprised when the lion sat there purring while he was sitting next to him, you know? Daniel didn't entrust himself in, well, I know that God will get me out of this situation. That wasn't his hope. His hope was that this is the God who judges justly. And in the divine court, as it were, because I have put my faith in him, I will be judged according to his standards and not according to the standards of men. And I think he says in here, in the same way what you were talking about, Deepak, that Christ was falsely accused by those who wanted to put an end to his life, and yet in the midst of the swirl of false charges and allegations, Jesus did not retaliate or revile in return. In fact, he uttered not a word, and he quotes 1 Peter 2, he continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. Same thing. Whole Bible connections, you know, he had stuff on angels and signs and wonders. Theological soundings, I thought this was good. Talking about common grace. There was no reason for Daniel to find favor in Darius's eyes. Yes, Daniel was a good guy. He had good character. He was, you know, he was trustworthy, all of that stuff. But there's been plenty of bad actors on the scene before. He had no reason to trust Daniel necessarily. But so God's common grace is shown just in that Darius, in his being much distressed by the situation, in verse 14, to the point of fasting through a sleepless night. I like this sentence right here. He said, "We can't help then but see in this story clear testimony to God's common grace, his restraining of those outside of his covenant purposes in a way that causes them to bless those who are inside of his covenant purposes." There's no reason for the outside world to treat believers well There's no reason for it. It's only in common grace of God that he allows that and does make that happen sometimes. And then he ties it to Paul's experience in Acts 26 with King Agrippa, and specifically in 1 Timothy 2:2, this is the reason that we should pray for kings and all who are in high positions, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way, that we need to be petitioning God that we would find grace and favor in the eyes of those who, in some sense, control our earthly fate, you know, the direction of... I was listening to Al Mohler this week. I don't know if you guys ever listen to Al Mohler podcast. Some of you do because I've told you to listen to him. He's the president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. He does a 25-minute podcast every morning at like 5 a.m. And it's just on current events, and he ties it to a Christian worldview. And he was talking about these abortion laws that are being passed in record pace. I mean, from, what, 1973? Was that Roe v. Wade? 1973 until last year, there was not much ground at all made on the pro-life side of the abortion debate. And within the past, really, 6 or 8 months, there has been states passing law after law. Like Alabama, this past week, banning abortion entirely. And Dr. Mohler was just talking about how this isn't just because we've politically caught the right wind, you know? When you're surfing or something and you just happen to catch the right wave and you ride it, that's not what's going on here. This is God and his common grace causing something to happen. And that's the reason that we pray for kings and all who are in high positions, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, is because God does work in these means. So I was encouraged by that. I think that's a big thing there in Daniel 6. I didn't want to pass over that. We're looking at the gospel glimpses on down the list from the end of Daniel 6. You guys didn't finish those last week. So the last thing is just personal implications. If you had anything else, throw it out there. And then we'll get into this crazy chapter of Daniel 7 here and try to figure out what's going on. All right. Sorry, I don't have much voice left, but I'm going to make it. We'll do it. Let me read here then Daniel chapter 7. And I don't think we're going to get past verse 8 tonight. So if you only have an attention span, if you only have a very short attention span, just try to pay attention to at least the first 8 verses. That's what I'm getting at. So, Daniel chapter 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And it was told, arise, devour much flesh. After this, I looked, and behold, another, like a leopard with 4 wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up from them another horn, a little one, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and the mouth and a mouth speaking great things. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before it. 1,000 thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking, and as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the cloud of heaven, there came one like a son of man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious, and the visions of my head alarmed me. I approached one of those who stood there and asked him the truth concerning all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of the things. These four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever, and ever. Then I desired to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the rest, exceedingly terrifying with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, and which devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. And about the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn that came up, and before which three of them fell, the horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke with great things, and that seemed greater than its companions. As I looked, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High. And the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all the kingdoms, and it shall devour the whole earth and trample it down and break it to pieces. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings shall arise, and another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the former ones, and shall put down 3 kings. He shall speak words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and shall think to change the times and the law. And they shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. But the court shall sit in judgment, and this dominion, and his dominion shall be taken away, to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Here is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me, and my color changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. Amen. So we probably don't even need to go over this, right? Because you guys have that all figured out. It all makes sense. Yeah? Okay. All right, I'm going to try not to blow in this mic. We're in Revelation Tuesday nights, right? It sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? Sort of sounds like they maybe had the same source, doesn't it? Okay, so here's what... These are the questions. I have to say, he kind of skips through all the good stuff, so I may have added a little bit in here. We'll see how much we get through. But so he asks the question, and he just says at the top of 61, students of the book of Daniel continue to debate the identity of the four beasts mentioned in this vision. Consulting the ESV study Bible would be of help, but what can we say with some assurance about these beasts? And then he just moves on. And I'm like, Todd, that's not fair. We need to talk about these beasts. So, we're going to talk about them. But first, let's look at what he says. The place of the passage here, we start getting into what's known as an apocalyptic genre. An apocalyptic, usually it's kind of a scary word to people, you know. I don't know if it's because we watch the History Channel and we see the aliens landing on the pyramids and the battles in the sky with the missiles and the explosions and all that stuff, and that's what we think about when we think of apocalyptic. But that's not exactly what apocalyptic is talking about. There's a whole bunch to it, but particularly he pulls it out here in this paragraph on the place of the passage that I wanted to mention before we jump into these questions. When we're talking about an apocalyptic genre, this is this revelation of what's going to happen. That's what apocalypsis in the Greek means, an unveiling, an opening, a revealing. The particular aim of a biblical apocalyptic genre, which you see here in Daniel chapter 7 to the end and then in Revelation, is particularly to encourage God's people in the midst, he says, of their exile here in Daniel. And we know that in Revelation, right? The purpose of Revelation is to encourage God's people in the midst of a terrifying and dying world. That's the point. It's for hope and for encouragement in the midst of difficulty. I think that's different than how you normally hear maybe Daniel 7 and on in Revelation talked about, right? This is a Rubik's Cube of end times information, and it's terrifying, and unlock it if you can. That's sort of how it's understood. But the point of it is to encourage God's people. He says the overarching message of these chapters is that God is triumphantly in control of the unfolding history and thus has good purposes in store for his beleaguered and persecuted people. We've seen that in the first six chapters, haven't we? Over and over and over again, the purpose of the first six chapters is to show that God is sovereignly in control of history, right? So he takes us in these first six chapters, teaching us this message that God is specifically in control of history, and then we get to chapter 7. And I don't want to give you the answer because he asked this question right here, so I'll read the question. This is on page, wow, I have 60. I wrote so much down here on the bottom, I can't even see the page number. He says, note, this is the first question. Note that the vision Daniel receives in this chapter takes place during the first year of Belshazzar's reign. Did you guys notice that? If you read the question, then you should have noticed it. But if you didn't, did you notice that we started off in the midst of the first year of Belshazzar's reign? The events of this chapter, therefore, are chronologically prior to the events of chapters 5 and 6. Remember, Belshazzar is the one who was king in chapter 5 and had the handwriting on the wall and his knees were knocking and he had an accident on the floor and then he was dead by the end of the night. That's what the Hebrew says. I'm not making a joke. That's what it says. That's who this is. So this is two chapters later, chapter 7, in the first year of his reign. So the question is, why do you think this chapter appears here rather than earlier in the book? Now, do you have any ideas? Throw it out there. What's Daniel doing? So think about the structure. I just gave you a hint. Think about the structure. We've got these first six chapters of history where Daniel is reciting for us the way that God has so far sovereignly been in control of what's going on in his people's life and obviously throughout the world because he's controlling these foreign kings. And so far, foreign kings from two different empires, right? Then we get to chapter 7, and where are we looking now? Where's the view from chapter 7 on? What's Daniel pointing us to? I'll ask it this way. Has this stuff happened yet that we just read in Daniel chapter 7? Some of you may say yes, but has the crushing, the Ancient of Days, and presenting the kingdom, trampling under feet, and people taking an everlasting kingdom and dominion forever and ever, and all of this stuff, have all these events taken place yet? No. Okay, someone said no. Thank you. That's all I was looking for. So this would be then not the past or the present, but the future. All right. Good. We're on the same page. So chapters 1 through 6, he's been looking at history, right? Chapter 7, where are we looking? At least to Daniel, we're looking at the future. We may have our different interpretations of whether this has happened yet or not, but at least from Daniel's vantage point right here, we're talking future. So what do you think Daniel's going to start doing now? Why do you think he gives us this message right now? Why do you think he starts going out of order from where he was? That's his question. I'm just ruining my book. It's okay if you don't know. But he's going to say something. What are you going to say? Well, no, he's asking it. I'm not asking it. He's asking. Yeah, so why didn't he... Remember that outline that Mike gave us at the beginning? I know you don't remember the details of it. I don't remember it either, but I thought I had it. I can't find it. You know. But if he's been going in chronological order, why didn't he stick chapter 7 before chapter 5? What's that?
To show that God's sovereign.
Yes. Sovereign where? So far he's been sovereign in the past. He's going to be sovereign over the future too, right? Yeah, exactly. And... Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so far Daniel has been showing us God's sovereign control of history down to the detail of closing a lion's mouth so that his servant wouldn't be... I mean, think about it on the grand scale of... the grand scheme of things, right? How long has the earth been around? At minimum, 6,000 years, right? You talk to some people, it's been a couple billion. I don't know the answer, but we're going to say minimum 6,000 years. A lion is pretty minor on the scale of things, right? He cares enough to close a lion's mouth and can do it. On the grand scheme of things, we've got empires that are taking over the world. And he made one of them eat grass for 7 years, or at least 7 months, right? He's in control of the little things and the big things, from the little to the big over history. That's what he's dictated to us so far. And then he starts telling us about some pretty terrifying stuff in the future. I think his point is that he is going to be finally in control of those things too, to the fine details. I think that's what he's going after. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Space, distance, time, life, death, all of it. He's in control of all of it. And he's dictated that to us so far. And so we should step into chapter 7 terrified, right? Daniel's terrified. He says his color leaves him. But not terrified in this sense that there's unknown and that nobody's in control of the future, but that this God who's been in control of everything so far is going to be in control of this also. So that's one thing that's I think is the reason for this shift. Another thing is this is the beginning of these four visions that Daniel's given. Chapter 7, chapter 8, chapter 9, and then 10 and on. There's four visions. So we start seeing those. Another thing is, here's another question. What is different? We've seen a couple of visions so far, right? Two, I think. I think we've seen two, if my math's correct. It's not hard math, but I can't seem to handle it. What's different about this vision than the other visions? At least, what's different about the recipient of this vision compared to the other visions? Yeah, but who got that vision? So far, we've had two visions, right? Or two dreams, same thing. Who have the recipients been? And what's different about this one and this recipient? Yeah. So they've been unbelieving kings, right? And this one's given to Daniel. That's a shift. That's a major shift right there. And they needed interpreters. And Daniel was the interpreter for them. Daniel asks for an interpreter here, doesn't he? What verse was it? Oh, I lost it. It's like 15 or something. Yeah. He asks for an interpretation of the things in verse 16. Of course, God interprets it for him. So he needs an interpreter. But think about this. Mike mentioned this 4 months ago now at this point. But the first six chapters of the book here are written as a witness to the outside world, right? Remember the shift? These chapters are written in Aramaic, which is the language of the nations surrounding Israel. Daniel chapter 7 is written in Aramaic. Starting in Daniel chapter 8, I believe, is when we get back to Hebrew. And so these previous chapters have been a witness to the outside world of the sovereignty of God, I think. And then 7 and on, with this interpretation coming to Daniel to encourage the saints that God's in control of the future, is specifically given to the people of God. So there's a lot going on with just right there that in the year of Belshazzar. As we go, why did he change the time period here? I don't even know what that says. That's some chicken scratch right there. So I'm going to pass over that sentence because I don't know what it says. All right, we'll call that one wrapped up. Question number two then. It says, review the content of Daniel's vision in these opening verses. What is the author trying to communicate through, and then he gives us some of these images. Imagery of darkness, blowing of the four winds, the stirring of a great sea, and the appearance of mutant beasts out of this frothy chaos. And then what does this teach us about history and earthly kings and kingdoms? So first, he says, what's he trying to communicate through the image of darkness? Because he says, Daniel declared, I saw in my vision by night. And behold, some of the interpretations say, I saw a dark vision. So I think the answer to that one is that it was nighttime. So let's just pass over that one for now, because that one seems sort of silly. But what does he mean? What is he invoking with these images? The blowing of four winds, stirring of a great sea, appearance of mutant beasts out of the frothy chaos. What is he trying to communicate through the imagery? My Tego. What do you think? Tumultuous times? Yeah, that's good. Yes, absolutely. Anybody have anything else? You might not be apocalyptic genre experts, but neither am I.
So that's okay.
So remember, John in Revelation, he's using Daniel, not the other way around. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it's rain. Yeah. So John in Revelation, I think Revelation is based on Daniel. The whole book of Daniel. So think about this. Let's put it in this sense. Let's say you're not reading a book written by an old dead guy from 2,500 years ago right now. You're sitting in a movie theater, okay? And it's dark. There's these four winds blowing. You see a stirring of a great sea, and then you see mutant beasts rising out of a frothy chaos. Here's the question. What's the director trying to do? To you, the viewer. Yeah. Trying to scare you a little bit, right? And what was it that you said? Tumultuous times. Yeah, both of those things are true. He's doing a couple things. First, he's showing there's some tumultuous, chaotic stuff happening. And then for us, the readers, we're sort of sitting back in our seats going, what on earth is happening right now? I'm a little concerned, right? And that's on the screen. Daniel's sleeping and sees this in his dream, right? This is meant to be, at the very least, terrifying. And that was the result, wasn't it? As Daniel said at the end, "As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me and my color changed." That means, doesn't mean you got a suntan, right? It means all the blood rushed out of my face because I was scared. My thoughts greatly alarmed me. He was terrified. That's partly what's going on here. Just to break these things down, four winds, typically, when it talks about four winds in the Bible, it refers to the far reaches of the earth. So think about the compass. You've got all four directions and you've got winds. Four winds, it's really talking about the far reaches of the earth. So here you have four winds of heaven stirring up the great sea. You've got the entire earth involved in this venture. The great sea in Revelation, New Testament apocalyptic genre, sea typically does refer to chaos. In the ancient Near Eastern mythology, the gods rose out of the primordial sea. That's where they came from. Sounds cool, I guess. I mean, we think that stuff sounds crazy, but then we go watch movies like Aquaman or Thor or something like that, and that's exactly what they're doing on screen. It's just their mythology. So in the ancient Near East, they thought of the sea as this sort of primordial ooze of chaos. They didn't. If you go out on the sea in a boat, and you spring a leak, and you're 1,000 miles away from shore, like, it's been nice knowing you. You're not getting back, right? There's no swimming. You're going to drown. That's the sea was chaotic. And so it was evil, eternal forces underneath the sea that were devouring people. And so they pictured in their mythology gods rising out of the sea. So that's one interpretation. I don't think that one is the correct one, though. I think it's correct in New Testament times, in sort of a Greek time, but in a Hebrew time, I don't think so. I think based on a few other verses in the Bible, in Hebrew scriptures, specifically Isaiah 57, verse 20, the wicked are like a tossing sea, for it cannot be quiet, and its waters stir up mire and dirt. And I also wrote down Jeremiah 6:23, which says, "They lay hold on bow and javelin. They are cruel and have no mercy. The sound of them is like a roaring sea. They ride on horses set in array as a man for battle against you, O daughter of Zion." It seems like in Hebrew scriptures, the picture of a sea tends to be the picture of a large multitude of people. So I think chaos is certainly there, but I think it's particularly talking about a large group of people. And since we're talking about the four winds of heaven, all earth being involved, and the stirring of the great sea and the four winds of heaven, I think we're talking about all peoples on the globe. I think that's what he's picturing here. So far we're getting a pretty big picture, aren't we? You know, this is big. And then we have these beasts, and we're going to talk about the beasts. But in the interpretation, he asks what's going on. And he says that the beasts are kings. Where is that? Verse 17, "These four beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth." And when he says kings, he doesn't specifically mean that person necessarily, but what the king represents. The king is the representative of the entire kingdom and nation. So you have four winds of the earth, four winds of heaven, all directions of the earth, the stirring of the great sea, all peoples, and then out of these peoples, these mutant beasts rising out of this chaos. These kingdoms are rising out of the peoples of the earth. And so the second question he asks, what does this teach us about history and earthly kings and kingdoms? And I think it's probably best to add in, we'll talk through these beasts, but as we get through verses 3 through 8 and all the stuff that's going on in the midst of all of this territory that he's talked about, what does this teach us about history and earthly kings and kingdoms? What's that? They've come and gone, yeah. Certainly. And they've done what when they've been around? What's that? I heard a word. Battle? Yeah, there's been conquest, bloodshed, death, right? I mean, devouring. Look at all the words. Conflict, conquest, control, dominion. I think what it teaches us about history and the earthly kings and kingdoms is that history is gruesome and terrifying. Right? I mean, this is a scary picture. Especially since we know that these beasts represent kings, kingdoms arising out of the peoples of the earth, and then we start realizing what they're doing. I saw a second one like a bear, raised up on one side, and it had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, "Arise, devour much flesh." You go, oh, that's representing a kingdom? Goodness. Right? History is gruesome. And they're bent on domination and power. And no matter how many people they trample over and devour, right? So this is what apocalyptic genre does that I think's good to remind us of right here, is that this is terrifying. This is telling us some truth about history and kings and kingdoms. But it's not pulling any punches on truth, is it? So the reason that, like, when you watch the history, I don't know, History Channel's more just like game shows now, isn't it? It's not even good anymore. But used to, History Channels would always show, like, some apocalyptic something going on in there. It would be explosions and seas and boats and things like that. And the reason apocalyptic genre would always have those pictures is not because they're necessarily trying to scare you by putting a bunch of fake scary stuff, but because apocalyptic genre, more than anything, pulls out the darkness that is reality. And then they take that darkness and then they show us through this the hope that we have in the sovereign one through that history. That's what apocalyptic genre does. One of the authors said that apocalyptic genre really highlights the total depravity of mankind through what it pictures. I don't think you can get out of this picture without realizing the depravity of man. I wanted to read this guy, Dale Ralph Davis. He's hilarious. Maybe not what most people would find hilarious, but this is a good book. Daniel commentary. I just wanted to read, because we think, I did mention it this morning about 20th century history being bloody and gruesome, but we don't think about, we tend to kind of block that stuff out, don't we? History's not that bad. Things aren't that bad. Bad things haven't really happened that much. And he writes about, he says, sometimes one must descend to particulars to feel the point that this terrifying narrative is trying to tell us. The last century provides too many samples. Turkish government troops had already killed up to 100,000 Armenians in 1895 to 1896. Then in 1915, the Turks accused the Armenians of assisting Russian invaders, and so 24th of April was set as Armenian Liquidation Day. As many as 600,000 died that day. Many under great cruelty, like having their heads placed in vices and squeezed until they collapsed. Then Koreans, when they protested Japanese tyranny in 1919, men and boys had their fingers passed over with hot red wires, toenails pulled out, flogged repeatedly until taken to the hospital. Big slabs of skin had to be cut off. This is gross, right? It's gruesome. Then there was Black Friday during World War II, and Japanese troops went through Alexandra Hospital in Singapore, bayoneting all patients, doctors, and nurses, and then tied hundreds of Chinese hand-to-hand and massacred them on the beaches. Sometimes the brutality can be laid at the feet of a single dictator. In 1932, Joseph Stalin demanded grain deliveries from the Ukrainian peasantry, quotas that were larger than the total crop. The demand was ruthlessly enforced, and at least 5 million, more likely 7 million, simply starved to death. And in the 1970s, I can't say his name, Idi Amin, maybe, carried out his own style of carnage in Uganda, sledgehammering prisoners. And it just gets worse from here. Gross. And this is, that was 30 years in the 20th century. It's nasty. That's history. And we don't think about that stuff. And there's way worse stuff that went on. And this is the reality of man's dominion and empire. This is what it looks like. This is what it's always looked like. The reason the Assyrians were as good as they were at taking over empires was because of how terrified people were of standing up against them. If they caught you, they would not just literally rip you apart limb from limb, they would do that, but they would rip the insides out too. I mean, it's gross. And that's what dominion and dynasty and empire has looked like from the beginning. And so what Daniel 7 here is pulling out for us is he's not making this darker than it is. He's showing us what history looks like, what empires look like. And so, look at these beasts. Do we have time? We don't have much time, do we? We're running out of time. We didn't even get to the beasts yet. My goodness. Okay. We'll look at these real quick. You've got four beasts, don't you? The first beast is what? He looks like a lion, and he has eagle's wings. I don't know what that looks like, but there it is. And then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and the mind of a man was given to it. So before we do this, you've got these four kingdoms. Have we seen four kingdoms yet in Daniel? Somewhere? Maybe earlier, yeah. Where was that? Daniel chapter 2, right? Yeah. Yeah. And you remember what those kingdoms were? You've got the head of gold and I don't remember all the what they were. You had the head of gold, which was Babylon. And then you had the chest of silver or something like that. That was... It would really help to write this stuff down, wouldn't it be? I see it. I just don't see this. Okay, there it is. Where does it start? Verse 36 of chapter 2. Well, he says in end of verse 38, you are the head of gold. There's Babylon. Verse 39, another kingdom inferior to you shall rise after you. That's the chest. I think it was silver. And yet a third kingdom of bronze. Those are the legs or the torso. That's the Medo-Persian Empire. And then there shall be a fourth kingdom strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things. He says that the feet, that we find that that's Rome. I think these kingdoms correspond to Daniel chapter 2 right here. They're just represented by these beasts. And so you have the first like a lion and had eagle's wings. Nebuchadnezzar was referred to and has been referred to in the Bible as a lion a few places. Jeremiah 4, 7, 50, verse 17. So I think specifically the lion with the eagle's wings speaks of Babylon's rule when Nebuchadnezzar was king, and the wings speak of swiftness. So they were able to swiftly come and take over what it was that they were going to take over. But the wings were plucked, which sounds painful. And with the wings being plucked, that's a slowing down of the kingdom. And we see then he was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. I don't think this is necessarily speaking of the restoration of Nebuchadnezzar. That's what's happening here, is when he was made to stand like a man, that's talking about the time that the king was humbled to the ground. But I think you see a decline. You see a lion with eagle's wings, and then you just have a lion because the wings have been taken off, and then you see him as a man. And so it's not necessarily talking about him being lifted up from not having to eat off the ground anymore, but the decline in the kingdom's power and presence. And we know that that took place. That's all there. That's the first beast. The second beast would be the Medo-Persian Empire. And so notice verse 5. Another beast, a second one like a bear. It says it was raised up on one side. That's not speaking of the front or the back. That's speaking of the side. The Medo-Persian Empire were the Medians and the Persians together. And the Persians were always the stronger part of the empire. So people interpret this to be that on one side of this joined empire that is lifted up because the Persians were stronger. And I think they're right about that. But notice they have three ribs in their mouth. And so that's talking about conquest. Bears, by the way, were thought of just like lions. Same ferocity. I wouldn't want to run into a bear or a lion, personally. I certainly wouldn't want to run into a bear with three ribs in its mouth. I don't think these were baby back ribs from Chili's. I think it had just devoured something and just killed it, right? But there's something said in the fact that it only has three ribs in its mouth. And I think what that points to is that they didn't take over in the world in its entirety. They were limited in their power. And there's a few things throughout this chapter. We're not going to get to it because we got to stop here. But you hear a voice or you see a passive word here numerous times throughout this chapter, and you always have to ask the question: who's doing? If this passive thing is happening to somebody, who's doing the action? Right. So here's the bear, three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, "Arise, devour much flesh." Here's the question we should ask. Who told this bear, arise, devour much flesh? That's an important question to ask. Who in history has the power to tell a nation as powerful as this, to give them this type of power and give them their edict? This is what you're going to do as a nation. Arise, devour much flesh. I don't think we can interpret that as anybody other than God himself. He's the one giving them this power, right? Real quick, I'll say these others and then we're going to have to stop. And I'll tell Mike that we didn't even get to the beast, so he can do that next. By the way, before we do that, next week's Memorial Day, we are not going to have Sunday evening service. Mainly because nobody will be here. So that seems like a good reason, I think, right? So the third beast, let me just say what they are and then we'll close. The third beast is Greece, I think. Some people interpret this to be Babylon, Medians, Persians, and then Greece. But I think it's Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and then Rome. I think Rome is the fourth beast. So the third beast, four wings, four heads. You're talking about more speed, swift, Greece. Alexander the Great took over the known world in 10 years. Nobody in history has ever done that as fast, nor will they ever do it that fast again. 10 years to take over the entire world at 33 years old. That's Alexander the Great. And so you, four wings and four heads. Speedy, mobile, the four winds related to this, the known world. The four heads symbolic for ambition and vision, for conquest in all of its devices. Look at this, one more thing. After this I looked and behold, another like a leopard, fast, four wings of a bird on its back, swift, and the beast had four heads. And look, here's a passive, and dominion was given to it. Who gave this leopard dominion? I think it's the same one who said, arise, devour much flesh. God is sovereignly in control of coming history. And then this last beast, the fourth beast, verse 7, Daniel doesn't even describe it to look like an animal. The other ones at least looked like an animal. Verse 7, after this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast. This is how he describes it. Terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. And that's what Rome was. Terrifying, dreadful, exceedingly strong. Strong, by the way, is the same word used of the legs of iron in Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Iron teeth, it's the same metal. This is the only one of all of these previous kingdoms that completely conquer, devour, break in pieces, and they're ruthless in that they don't just devour, they stamp out what was left with its feet. That was Rome. Rome was a terrifying place, and you didn't want to get in Rome's way. So we'll stop there. And you can all just wonder what horns are until 2 weeks from now. How does that sound? Well, tell Mike that's where we left off. You need to explain what horns are. Can you do that? Does that sound good? All right. Deepak, do you mind praying for us?